Thursday's UN mission slammed statements by the Israeli premier at the UN General Assembly, accusing Netanyahu of Iranophobia and spreading lies about the Islamic Republic. And U.S. media say Washington will deliver long-range missiles to Ukraine amid warnings by Russia that the influx of Western arms will only prolong the war. Well, welcome to our studio scene in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, can be revived if the U.S. abandons its double standards. Hossein Amir Abdollahian urged Washington to show its will for the revival of the pact and consequently the removal of anti-Iran sanctions. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was signed between Iran, China, Russia, the U.S., France, Germany, and the U.K. in 2015. But the deal was torpedoed after the former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Tehran. The Islamic Republic says it has abided by its commitments under the deal, blaming the U.S. for its unilateral withdrawal. Iran's armed forces have held military parades across the country on the first day of the Sacred Defense Week. That's an occasion marking the start of an eight-year war imposed on Iran in the 1980s by then-Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. In the capital, Tehran, the military parade was held at Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. Here's a report from our correspondent, Mahdi Abbasian, who has been present at the venue in Tehran.
The Iranian armed forces held military parades across the country on the first day of Sacred Defense Week. This annual event marked the anniversary of the beginning of an eight-year war imposed on Iran by then-Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. It is celebrated across the country to remember and honor war martyrs and veterans. In the capital, Tehran, the parades began at the mausoleum of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Different units of the Iranian army, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, law enforcement forces, border guards, and Basij volunteer forces participated in the parades. The participants marched in front of Iran's top military brass, as well as military attachés of the countries which have embassies in Iran. Representatives of different Iranian ethnic groups, including Kurds, Lurs, Turkmens, Arabs, and Baluch, also took part in the parade. Also in the event, Iranian domestic military products, including various drones and missiles, were put on display. One of the highlights of this year's parade in Tehran was the display of two Fatah hypersonic missiles and a Pava cruise missile. Addressing the parade in Tehran, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi praised the country's defense accomplishments and its capacity for weapons production, saying they show how the country's armed forces have turned the sanctions into opportunities.
We have transformed from a country that imported and stored other countries' weapons to a country that produces and exports weapons. Today, countries in the region and beyond admit that Iran's armed forces are powerful. They all agree that their armed forces have significant deterrent power.
Raisi also emphasized that a defensive approach aimed at ensuring sustainable security and deterrence was a fundamental policy of the Islamic Republic.
Today, war and domination have no place in Iran's military doctrine, but it's our definite policy to maintain military preparedness to achieve sustainable security and ensure deterrence.
The president underscored the fact that Iran's enhanced military capabilities, particularly in terms of training and equipment, are recognized both regionally and globally.
Today, the Iranian armed forces are stronger than ever and are fully prepared to deal with the threats of the enemies of the Islamic Republic. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Iran has criticized the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Iran, Javed Rehman, for his links with the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin Khalq. Kazem Gharibabadi, the secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, raised the issue in a letter to the UN Rights Council. He accused Rehman of supporting the MEK that has spilled the blood of thousands of Iranians. He said Rehman's remarks in a UK parliamentary session in July well indicated his link and support to the terror group. He said Rahman's stance also showed that his appointment was merely based on political motivations and had nothing to do with human rights. Gharibabadi also slammed what he called the biased stance of the rapper, lamenting that he was never supported Iranian victims of terrorism or illegal Western sanctions. Iran has repeatedly censored Rahman's reports on the situation of human rights in Iran. Iran has denounced the Israeli Prime Minister for his rhetoric during an address to the UN General Assembly. Iran's mission to the UN has described Benjamin Netanyahu's speech as a comedy show. In a statement, the Iranian mission said Israel has always used the UN to spread disinformation and to level baseless allegations against Iran. It added that the regime is seeking to divert attention away from its crimes and apartheid policies against Palestinians. According to the statement, the Israeli Prime Minister is trying to portray Iran's peaceful nuclear program as a threat to global peace. That is while the regime possesses all types of weapons of mass destruction and is the main obstacle to West Asia free from nuclear weapons. On Friday, Netanyahu repeated his allegations against Iran's nuclear activities during his UN address. He said, quote, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat to prevent it from acquiring a nuclear weapon. His office later corrected his speech, claiming that Netanyahu misread his prepared text, which called for, quote, a credible military threat against Iran's nuclear program. Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi is an activist and political analyst who joins us from Qom. Welcome to the program. When you have the Israeli Prime Minister basically accuse Iran of baseless allegations, whether it's its nuclear program or otherwise, does he even have a footing to level those types of accusations against Iran when, A, the entity itself possesses nuclear weapons and warheads? I think it's between 200 to 400. And, B, when it comes to the situation within Israel itself, we obviously see that this is an apartheid regime that's violating the rights of another, mainly the Palestinian people. So where does he come off making those types or accusing Iran of any type of accusations that it has?
Yeah, the point is that sometimes they were telling giving those rhetorics from Tel Aviv, but this time they use the platform of, you know, United Nations. And even if you look at the correction that they made, their office, that they said that what he meant was actually a military threat, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, the essence of his speech is the same. And ironically, he was, you know, repeating peace, the terminology of peace again and again in his speech. And in the same speech, he talks about threatening Iran, the major threat against Iran. And here I shall, you know, flash back to the recent interview of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, with Fox News, when the host asked him about a possible possession of nuclear weapon with Iran, then what would be your reaction? And MBS talked about, we should have a nuclear, you know, weapon in that case as well. I mean, these signals are not positive signals, specifically when we know more about the dynamics going on between Israel and Saudi Arabia from the other side. Benjamin Netanyahu started initiating his speech at UN talking about their connection and normalization of ties with Saudi Arabia, what he was claiming to be an achievement for the Israeli international affairs. But the reality is that what they are looking after from all these, you know, linkages, all these, you know, connections that the region is to bring more destruction for the region. And they openly misuse the platform of United Nations, where all the leaders of the world are coming and talking about peace, about, you know, normalization about the betterment of life, about resolving the issues, specifically Palestinian issue that was, you know, pushed by several leaders of both in the recent, you know, gathering of United Nations. Netanyahu is coming there, and they are shamelessly talking about threatening Iran, and that's quite ironic, and that shows how these double standards are going on. And as you mentioned, how this is, you know, like a joke, what Netanyahu is telling there, from one side emphasizing peace, claiming to be loving peace, on the other side threatening a nation, the whole nation. What does it mean? You are threatening the whole Iranian nation with a nuclear threat. You know, that's something I believe should be highlighted.
Indeed. Thank you so much for that. Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi, activist and political analyst from Qom. Thank you. Moving on, the U.S. has reportedly decided to provide Kiev with ATACMs long-range missiles after months of speculation. U.S. media reported that President Joe Biden has informed Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky of the decision. On Thursday, following a visit by Zelensky to Washington, the The White House announced a new $325 million military aid package for Kyiv and the delivery of the first Abrams tanks. However, the White House did not disclose any decision on the ATACMS missiles. Zelensky is currently in Canada, which has also pledged nearly $500 million in a new aid package. That includes some 50 armored vehicles, as well as training for F-16 fighter jets pilots. Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons into Ukraine will only prolong the war and add to the suffering of its people. Dmitry Zolotarev is a journalist who joins us from Irkutsk over in Russia. Welcome to the program, Dmitry Zolotarev. Tell us why it is dangerous for the U.S. to provide these missiles, because some are speculating that this, by some respects, could actually, if it got out of hand, lead to World War III.
I don't think it will lead to World War III, but I pretty much believe that any weapon is designed to kill, and despite whether it's good or bad, it kills. So Russia will find the way to cope this new type of weapon. Maybe not so new, because Ukraine already possesses with long-distance weapons such as Storm Shadow, British-made, French-made. So I think there will now be a big difference between ATAMCs, those American long-built, long-distance weapons, so and British-made, and Russia's reconnaissance and electronic devices, which are designed to suppress weapons like that before they reach the target, will cope with most of them. But anyway, as we see by the attack on Sevastopol, some of the rockets reach their targets. So this is not good. And if Russia's territory will be hit, it means Ukrainian territory will be hit in response, especially those areas where these weapons are located. Maybe Russia, I think pretty much likely, Russia will hit the ways which are used to deliver those weapons to Ukraine. Anyway, despite the fact that the United States will not provide with many of those, even a few can make a lot of harm. Anyway, this is an escalation, and the deeper United States get into it, yes, basically the closer to Third World War it goes, but I don't think it will lead finally to the Third World War, because, well, Zelensky and his friends, they don't fear, as they say, they don't fear the Third World War. But anyways, Europe and the United States do fear a Third World War, and I think they will make everything possible to avoid it, which sometimes is being contradicted by their actions. Anyway, I think it's bad, but it's not very big deal.
And
it's not a game changer, I'm sorry.
My final question, do you think that the way that the U.S. is providing Ukraine with weapons intermittently shows that Ukraine obviously is not winning the war, and the U.S. feels like it needs to up the ante in terms of the types of equipment that it's giving Ukraine, but ultimately will it make a difference in terms of the tide turning to Ukraine's favor?
Well, nothing is going to work in Ukraine's favor. Ukraine is losing decisively, and this only shows that the United States are waging this war against Russia up to the last Ukrainian. And they just prolonging the convulsion of the dying state, which is tragic. Ukraine is dying, and the population is dying. People are dying in huge numbers, which is the nation is dying. It's being wiped out, and I think the latest casualties show that the Ukrainian nation just received the most decisive defeat as a nation. It may just cease to exist in a few years because the most of male population is being killed at war. And the United States just was hesitating whether to provide Ukraine with those weapons or not, just because they are very much afraid that those rockets may be the trophy of Russians, which is pretty much likely in some point. But anyway, they are trying to prolong the death of the country in order to see what happens, how it affects Russia. They think they bring more harm to Russia, and the longer war is going on, the more harm they bring to Russia, which is absolutely their point. So I think they don't care about Ukraine. They don't care about Ukraine absolutely. They don't care if Ukraine just ceases to exist pretty much soon. So that's what's happening, I think.
Thank you for that. Dmitry Zolotarev, a journalist from Irkutsk over in Russia. Thank you. High-ranking U.S. Democratic Senator Robert Menendez has stepped down as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee following his indictment on bribery charges. Federal prosecutors charged Menendez and his wife with bribery over their relationship with three New Jersey businessmen. They said gold bars and hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash had been found at the senator's home. In one of several charges, the Justice Department said Menendez had delivered sensitive information to the Egyptian government in order to help an Egyptian-American businessman. It is the second corruption indictment in 8 years against a veteran politician. Prosecutors are seeking to have Menendez forfeit assets, including his New Jersey home. But the senator calls the allegations baseless and characterizes the indictment as a personal attack on him. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has repeated allegations that New Delhi was involved in the killing of a Sikh leader and called on New Delhi to cooperate in an investigation.
As I said on Monday, there are credible reasons to believe that agents of the government of India were involved in the killing of a Canadian on Canadian soil. And we call upon the government of India to engage with us to move forward on getting to the truth of this matter.
Trudeau declined to say what evidence Ottawa has. Relations between India and Canada have soured in the wake of the killing of Canadian Sikh activist Hardeep Singh Najjar in June. Najjar was an advocate for an independent Sikh state to be carved out of parts of India and Pakistan. The Indian government of Prime Minister Modi has rejected all allegations outright. Ottawa and New Delhi have already expelled senior diplomats in a tit-for-tat move. Moving now to the disputed South Caucasus region of Nagorno-Karabakh, ethnic Armenians are expected to lay down their arms under a deal with Azerbaijan following its brief military operation there. Moscow has confirmed the surrender of armed ethnic Armenians with the help of Russian peacekeepers. The military operation was launched on Tuesday, which set the stage for Baku to take full control of Nagorno-Karabakh. The region is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but it has been under the de facto Armenian control since the early 1990s. Azerbaijan's lightning offensive has raised concern over the safety of up to 120,000 ethnic Armenians living in the disputed mountainous region. The armed groups have said that they are engaged in Russian-mediated talks with Baku to organize the withdrawal process and to return the civilians displaced by the fighting. And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mirail neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirail is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside.
Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property, and we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. I mean, sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the sixth floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just two floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45-square-metre apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's, well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside when they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbour's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios.
Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside.
In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the Residents Association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. There was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed it and went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, this wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. Government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative.
Esse choque social gera um efeito negativo. onde o carro está entrando ali agora.
You see down there where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers, so it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are they less now? Oh, yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. Then the Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The US Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, if you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, brothers and sisters from every little parts of this world. IRIB English Radio again, and you're listening to the program For a Better Life. I am Bita, and again, I'm honored to be with you in this episode. As you know, there are times in everybody's life that we may feel like, okay, this is really difficult. Why should I go through all these difficulties in my life? What could be the reason of all these difficulties? Why me? You know, these are the questions I think all the people, even you, everyone, every each of you, dear listeners, have been gone through this. So I think we have to talk more about the philosophy of undesirable events in life. You know, we can repeat that we should not create difficulties for ourselves. You know, sometimes this actual philosophy that, okay, there may be some difficulties in everybody's life, but it doesn't mean that you have to make difficulties in order to improve your life. No, it means that if you face a condition which is difficult for you, you have to maintain balance. You have to go and find an opportunity to seize the moment of difficulty and develop your life and go for a better life. So, at the same time, it often happens that difficulties increase our willpower, just like iron, which is strengthened when placed in hot smelting pots. In the smelting pots of difficulties, we become experienced and more persevering. War, for example, is basically not good, but sometimes a difficult and long war causes the abilities of a nation to blossom and transform into unity and quickly makes up for our falling behind. A famous Arab historian says this beautiful quote: "The blossoming of civilization has appeared throughout history in various parts of the world. It followed a country being attacked by a powerful foreign country, being awakened, and mobilizing their forces." Of course, reactions to difficulties are not similar among all people in all societies. One group falls into despair, weakness, pessimism, and reaches a negative conclusion, but there are individuals who have the right attitude when faced by these difficulties and are actually stimulated, mobilized by them, begin to move, and they are filled with excitement and enthusiasm. So it doesn't mean that difficulty means an opportunity to be successful. No, it depends on your actually reaction, your attitude towards every difficulty you face in your life. There are times like we actually face difficulties, and the only thing we can achieve from this difficulty is weakness, is actually despair, is all these negative conclusions. But if we maintain the right personality, if we maintain the right mindset, facing difficult situations, actually it will lead us to a level that we can use every difficulty and turn it into an opportunity to have a better life. So, because in such situations, many people judge by what appears in the surface, they only see the bitterness and difficulties and ignore the positive and constructive effects. So, let's keep it here, go for a short break, then we're going to come back. Stay tuned, dear listeners.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need,
oh, 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 oh,
For a better life, here again, and we're talking about the philosophy of difficult and undesirable events in everybody's life, and different reactions towards all these difficulties that we have in our lives as actually separated individuals. And if you study the life of geniuses of the world, you will see that almost all of them suffer difficulties and great misfortunes. There are fewer people who are raised in comfort and luxury, who have shown themselves to be geniuses and who have risen to a high position. A good commander of an army is a person who has been a difficult and long, who has seen a difficult and long battle. Their economic genius are people who have fallen into difficulties in the economic market. And our great politicians are those who have passed through hard and difficult political struggles. In summary, we can say that difficulties and undesirable events in everybody's life actually nurtures them, nurture everybody's soul. And these are the keys in order to have a better and more meaningful life. And let's have this quote and this beautiful verse from Holy Quran, which says, "It may be that it is like a thing, and God brings about through it a great deal of good for you." This is really beautiful. It means that sometimes if we feel like you are being tortured, you are suffering, you are actually being discriminated, you are being in a life that you don't deserve, but maybe this is all you think because your wisdom is not complete and you cannot see the future, and because you're an imperfect creature, you cannot understand the depth of the wisdom of Allah and the wisdom of every event that happened in your life. In the previous episodes, we have seen that little by little our being has a goal or purpose. Our eyes are for a purpose. Our ears are for a purpose. Our heart, brain, nerves, each have been created for a purpose. Even our fingers, tips have a philosophy behind them. So as I told you, everything has a reason. Thus, how is it possible that our total being be without a purpose? You know? At the same time, for the completion of these tasks, one must look every once in a while, scenes must be shown or pointed at. In facing difficulties, in following God's commands, one becomes familiar with one's ugly and evil deeds and will turn back to God. It is here that a part of the difficulties and unforeseen events are, in reality, some blessings. And the Holy Quran says, "Corruption has appeared on land and sea because of the deed that the hands of men have earned, that God may give them a taste of some of their deeds in order that they may turn back from evil." These difficulties and these undesirable events in everybody's life sometimes is a sign of blessing. Let's keep it here, go for a short break. You know, it's the same thing, I don't like these breaks. Maybe there is a wisdom behind them. Thank you for listening to us. Stay tuned. IRIB English Radio, the program for a better life. Again, we were talking about the wisdom behind the undesirable events that happen in everybody's life, that we may face them. And, nothing what we have said above, painful events are confirmations of evil and interpreting them as, you know, calamities that are considered to be in a position to justice is far from logic and intellectual reasoning, because the further we go into this narrow way, we will better understand the various philosophies. As I told you up to here, sometimes people commit sins and they put themselves in difficult situations and difficulties. And these difficulties in everybody's life can be a blessing. How? In a way that maybe this is a taste of some of their deeds, maybe, in order that they may turn back from evil. So, at the end of this episode, I want to tell you, dear listeners, that there may be some difficult times in everybody's life, like my life, like your life, like every individual on earth. But it doesn't mean that this is the end. This is the end of everything. This is what you deserve. This is exactly an exam that you have to pass in order to achieve to a higher level of development for your soul. So in order to have a better life, sometimes you have to go through so many difficulties. Thank you for listening to me. It was all the time I had for today's episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran says the 2015 nuclear deal can be revived if the U.S. abandons its double standards and shows willingness to remove anti-Iran sanctions.